Welcome to the Lemelson Center's podcast series on invention and innovation. I'm Laurel Fritsch, and on this podcast, we'll hear a lecture by Adam Mossoff, professor of law at George Mason University, based on his article, The Rise and Fall of the First American Patent Thing, The Sewing Machine War of the 1850s.
And so I'm here to talk to you about this research that I've been doing for several years now on the invention, patenting, litigation, and ultimately the successful commercialization of the sewing machine. And what's really most interesting about this, at least from a lot of people's perspective today, is the similarities between what happened in the antebellum era with invention and patenting and litigation over the sewing machine and what is happening now with smartphones and in high technology. Now, what do smartphones and sewing machines have in common? Well, the answer is they both have been the subject of what we refer to in the popular literature and newspapers as patent wars. We've all heard this. In fact, it's called the smartphone war, right? This is a patent war. It's not actual war. People aren't being killed. It's just litigation. Now, in the academic literature in the field of law, we refer to these not as patent wars. That's a little too cool of a phrase for us. So we prefer the more mundane phrase, a patent thicket. Now, the basic point in patent law is that too many patent owners, too many people have overlapping patent rights in the same commercial product, like a smartphone. There's multiple owners of the software, of the hardware, of the screen technology, of the design of it. That's a lot of Apple's patents are on the design, the shape of the buttons and the actual applications and whatnot. It's estimated that there are thousands of patents that actually cover a single smartphone that you have in your pocket or in your hand. That this is a thicket, and transaction costs are too high. Can't have licensing because transaction costs too high, so you won't have commercial development of the product. It's not unique to smartphones. There's patent thickets have occurred in recent years. Another example is in LASIK eye surgery. Now, what's really great about the sewing machine is that it challenges a lot of these assumptions that you have in the reports and the debates today about the smartphone war and patent thickets generally. One of the big assumptions that you have in reports on this is that this is a modern phenomenon. This has never occurred before. And they say, why has this never occurred before? Well, they say, well, first of all, there's been changes in the technology. And then you've had the expansion of patent law into these new areas of technology. So the sewing machine is an old technology, right? It's not high tech, or at least by our standards, it's not high tech. It was the smartphone of its day, but we don't view it anymore. It was a product of incremental invention. It was a product of multiple people contributing to the creation of this final product in the same way that occurs now with high technology and biotech. The sewing machine war of the 1850s, which was the litigation that arose following the ultimate conclusion of all of the inventive activities, was the very first patent thicket in U.S. history. It was prompted by what we refer to in the patent system as a non-practicing entity, the NPEs. They're also referred by these rhetorical slurs, a patent troll. This is a firm or an individual who doesn't manufacture, but who licenses the technology to other people to manufacture it. So people think that the rise of NPEs is a modern phenomenon, that this had never happened before. It occurred with the sewing machine even in other contexts at that time. The sewing machine war was solved by the sewing machine combination of 1856. We now call this a patent pool. A patent pool is when multiple owners of different patents that cover a technology get together to cross-license with each other. They all enter licenses with each other. I license you license me, I license this person, I license this other person. So it's multiple license between multiple people so that they all can get down to the business of actually commercializing the technology. They invented this as the solution to the sewing machine war. And in fact, the sewing machine combination was the very first American patent pool in U.S. history. And it was conceived of as the solution to these types of problems as patent thickets. And patent pools have always, therefore, been the solution to these types of problems like patent thickets. And so these are just kind of the summary of the types of issues I'm going to be touching on as I kind of go through the history and then talk about some of the lessons we can get from the history at the very end. So you might be wondering, why a patent thicket on a sewing machine? Well, the sewing machine, we think this is somewhat mundane technology, but this is actually, at its time, cutting-edge technology. It was the equivalent of the latest smartphone or radical new drug of its day. And as a result, it was the result of multiple different inventors having to invent different components of what ultimately became a practical, successful usable sewing machine. And so it was identified that it's actually 10 different elements of the sewing machine that had to be invented, right? Most people don't realize this, but you know, everything had to be invented about the sewing machine, because once something is invented or someone conceives of it, of course, it's totally obvious, right? It couldn't have been any other way. But for instance, someone had to figure out that sewing machines should be on a horizontal table. Some of the earlier devices, like Elias Howe's, worked vertically. So someone actually had to figure out, no, we should put this on a table, not on a wall. That'll make it more efficient. Someone had to work out, you know, the drive mechanism. So, to have a device run by what's called the treadle, the pivoting foot pedal, to power. This is before engines, before motors, dynamos, as they were called in the 19th century, as a way to get consistent power to operation of the needle. If someone had to figure out the presser foot to hold the cloth in place as the needle punctured the cloth so the cloth didn't move around. These were all elements that had to be invented to come up with an actual practical sewing machine. And in fact, the reality is that they were invented by different people. The big invention was the lock stitch. This was the one thing that really threw people off. It took about 100 years. People started trying to invent the sewing machine in the mid-18th century. It wasn't until the mid-19th century that they finally came up with a functioning sewing machine. And one of the big issues was figuring out how to do how to get the stitch. And a lot of the early inventors actually thought you had to replicate the motion of human hand in sewing. So some of the early sewing machines around the turn of the 19th century involved like these metal pincers that came out that grabbed the needle and pulled it through and then pulled it through again. And you can imagine these were not practical. And so it wasn't until they made a conceptual leap that to have mechanical sewing, you can't be replicating the human hand with sewing, that they were able to figure this out. And of course, the person who figured out the lock stitch was Elias Howe, who got a patent on it in 1846 on the use of an eye-pointed needle with one thread, another thread, and another shuttle, such that when they came down in a mechanized, synchronized motion, the threads interlock. That's why it's called a lock stitch, and that's what created the stitch. So what you had by the late 1840s, early 1850s, was the fact that the sewing machine, as I said, was the result of lots of different inventors who had been working for many, many years, many of them in failure. So unlike other antebellum inventions, right, so Samuel Colt with the repeating firearm, Charles Goodyear, vulcanized rubber, Eli Whitney, the cotton gin, the sewing machine was not the result of a single inventor. It was lots of different people working on different elements. So ultimately, you had this incremental invention until all of these different elements were invented by different people by the late 1840s, early 1850s. So one of them, of course, is Elias Howe. A lot of people know Elias Howe. Other people, of course, know Isaac Singer of the Singer Sewing Machine Company. But actually, Elias Howe and Isaac Singer were very much Johnny-come-latelys. I mean, they were actually, they came up with the last components of what things that people have been working on for many, many, many years. But the result, ultimately, of all of this inventive activity was that by the early 1850s, you had different patent owners and different firms who all own patents on different components of what was the successful commercial product of a sewing machine. And so when they started selling it, you had the sewing machine war. People started suing each other. Now, it was actually called the sewing machine war in the newspapers because it was partially fought in the newspapers. Howe took out ads attacking Singer. Singer took out ads attacking Howe. Other people took out ads. So it was, and it was being reported on also by the reporters at that time. It was referred to as the sewing machine war. So it was fought in the newspapers, for people were fighting for public opinion as well as in the courts. So very much like today with all the reporting on it and people vying for how things are going to be reported on. It was actually prompted by Elias Howe, who thought he came up with the solution to the sewing machine war, but only what he had really come up with was the invention of the lock stitch. As I said, his particular sewing machine was not really practicable. It worked on a vertical surface, which didn't allow for smooth transfer of the cloth through the sewing machine. Its needle was actually curved, not straight. It's eye-pointed needle, and so which the curving of the needle made it brittle, so it broke very oftentimes. And so it was not a very practical sewing machine. It didn't really work. And so he had not met with commercial success, had gone off to England to try to convince them invest in his sewing machine. They didn't. And while he was gone, other people like John Batchelder and Isaac Singer contributed the final elements to what became the workable sewing machine. When he came back, he discovers in New York City Isaac Singer's son working a sewing machine in a New York shop. And so he goes to Singer and says, you're infringing my patent. Your sewing machine uses the lock stitch. And he asks for a royalty from Singer of $2,000, to which Singer responded by threatening to throw him down the stairs and kill him. So Howe is destitute. So Howe actually had to find someone to invest in him for the sole purposes of threatening to bring a lawsuit. So he goes back to Singer and now demands a $25,000 royalty from Singer. Singer again refuses. $25,000 in 1851 is approximately $650,000 today. So not a small amount of money. And so no one budged. And so Howe starts bringing his patent infringement lawsuits. And he sues Singer, but he also sues all these other firms who had begun manufacturing sewing machines, because they all use sewing machines that use the lock stitch. Lowell, Blodgett, Wheeler, Wilson, Grover and Baker. Now, almost all of them immediately settle with Howe, but Howe and Singer keep fighting it out. And as a result of them keep fighting out, they all start suing each other and suing Singer, and they start suing Howe, and you have this explosion of litigation, just like we have now today with the smartphone. And in fact, you have all of the same problems that people talk about today. This is the fascinating thing about, I love history, because it really is true. Everything old is new again, right? So you're reading the accounts of the sewing machine war in the 1850s, and what are they complaining about? Oh, there's so many lawsuits. All these different lawsuits filed in different places, in Massachusetts, in the Northern District of New York, the Southern District of New York, in Philadelphia, in New Jersey, all of these different venues where people are suing each other. Multiple parties, right? So as I said, Howe was suing people as a plaintiff, but then people started suing Howe because Howe had to make models of his sewing machine as exhibits to use in court, and those infringed other people's patents who had patents on those components. So they started suing Howe. And so soon Howe was being named as a defendant. These were patent litigation lawsuits. So they were extremely complex and technical. One deposition record, just one, is reported to have been 3,500 pages in length. Now, this is a time before typewriters, right? Before computers. I mean, this was a handwritten deposition transcript of 3,500 pages in length. There was also arguments about the patents being invalid. Singer tried to invalidate Howe's patents. He looked as far as what is China to find what we call in patent law prior art, which is the evidence that the invention had been invented before, so it's not novel, which is a requirement for getting a patent. It has to be new. And in fact, he eventually convinced Walter Hunt, he's the inventor of the safety pin, he was a prolific antebellum inventor, to claim that he had invented the sewing machine with a lock stitch in 1834. And so they filed a special administrative proceeding at the patent office called an interference action, which took upwards of almost a year for that to conclude before the patent commissioner decided that no, Elias Howe was actually the true inventor of the lock stitch, or at least the person who had legitimately had the rights to it under patent law. You had non-practice entities suing, right? You had Elias Howe was not a manufacturer. He made his money from licensing, from entering into license agreements and getting royalties from the manufacturers. And he did this by threatening to get injunctions if they didn't pay him a license, which is why they did. So it's really interesting. You have all of these similarities between what was happening in the 1850s and what the complaints people have about smartphones today. And in fact, it was known at the time about Elias Howe. In fact, one contemporaneous report said that Elias Howe had litigated his way to fame and fortune. So he was even attacked for allegedly not really being a true inventor, a true contributor. So he was actually the very first prominent non-practicing entity who made almost all of his money. He made ultimately millions of dollars by the time he died from licensing his property rights and his patent to manufacturers. The solution to this litigation morass was ultimately what came to be called the sewing machine combination of 1856. This was the brainchild of Orlando Potter, who was actually one of the attorneys involved in the lawsuit. He was representing Grover and Baker. And on the eve of a very large patent trial in 1856 in New York, where all of the parties were then in one place, right? Because this is very significant, right? This is a time when it took a day and a half to travel by horse to go from New York to Boston. So he took advantage of the fact that all the relevant patent owners ended up in one place for one of the very first significant huge trials of the sewing machine war in 1856. And he got them all in one room. And by this time, it was four manufacturers, Singer, Wheeler, Wilson, Grover, and Baker, and then Elias Howe himself, and said, look, we should, instead of litigating, we should get together, license with each other, and start making a lot of money manufacturing our sewing machines, or at least Elias Howe, you can make a lot of money from all the license fees you'll get from us from manufacturing sewing machines. And of course they realized, yes, this is a great idea, Orlando, thank you. So they all got together and they made this agreement, and it was actually operated as a trust, and which is a lot of people don't realize too. So Orlando Hodder was actually the person who ran it as a trust. So all lawsuits now were Potter v. Whoever the infringer was for the patent infringement lawsuits. And it was actually the very first successful trust created at least 20 years before the more famous Standard Oil Trust came into existence. And it was run successfully until its final patent expired in 1877. As a result, all the manufacturers got down to manufacturing, and it was an incredible success story. Once the sewing machine combination was formed, you had an explosion in manufacturing of sewing machines. Hundreds of thousands of sewing machines started to be produced. And even during times of economic crisis, like the Panic of 1857, and even during the Civil War, the sewing machine manufacturing companies grew. Their sales grew, their profits grew, they were very, very successful. And so the sewing machine ended up becoming quintessential, fundamentals of the success of the Industrial Revolution in the 19th century. It was identified as one of the eight primary products that then formed the success of the Industrial Revolution in the 19th century. Singer Sewing Machine Company was actually the very first multinational corporation. In the 1860s, Singer Sewing Machine Company was selling more sewing machines in Europe than it was in the United States. And it was the very first civilian product that used machine tool parts, interchangeable parts. So as many of you know, Whitney invented this technology, and it was used primarily for manufacturing guns. And the sewing machine actually was the first civilian product to which this technology was applied. Singer soon became the face of the sewing machine combination, not just because of his technological prowess, but because of his incredible commercial innovation. So he and his business partners invent mass marketing techniques because we finally come up with the solution to the sewing machines. People have been hearing this for decades. And so he knew that he had to overcome this inherent prejudice against sewing machines, that this one actually was not going to work. So he would go to fairs and sing songs about how great the sewing machine was. And he and his business partner invent the first installment purchase program, what we now call rent-to-own, because sewing machines were extremely expensive. They cost about $125 at a time when the average American family only made about $400 a year. And that's a significant cost. And so they overcame that price problem by inventing rent-to-own. They invented the first trade-in program, right? Which was fantastic because sewing machines are made of iron, right? That's why I have a 150-year-old sewing machine in my office. They last forever. So how do you forestall a secondary market coming up in used sewing machines? Trade-in program. Trade in any used Singer sewing machine. Trade in any competitor's sewing machine and get $50 off the price of a new Singer sewing machine. The very first trade-in program in American history. And because of this commercial innovation, the Singer Sewing Machine Company soon becomes the largest manufacturer of sewing machines in the United States and in the world. And even more significant, that Singer had to confront prejudice against women at that time. And this is one of the reasons why the sewing machine was so significant, is that there was a prejudice in the antebellum era that women couldn't use machines. So it was either viewed as being they were incapable of doing this, or it was unwomanly for them doing this. And in fact, Singer himself was a bigot. When he was first asked to tinker with the sewing machine that was in his workshop of his business partner in 1850, his first initial response to it was, "What a devilish machine. It promises to take women away from the one thing that keeps them quiet, their sewing." But yet, he wanted to make money. He loved to say, "I'm interested in the dimes, not the invention." And so he was willing to overcome his own bigotry. And in fact, the very first full-time employee hired by Singer Sewing Machine Company was a woman. And she was hired for the purposes of teaching other women how to use sewing machines. And in fact, one of his splashy mass marketing techniques was they would put women operating his sewing machine in storefronts, in the windows, and huge crowds would gather around. There's a woman operating a sewing machine. They loved it. They got all this free publicity. And as a result of the sewing machine, women's time was opened up. They had a lot more free time because they could now sew much faster. The first sewing machines sewed upwards of 400 to 1,000 stitches per minute, whereas the average by hand stitch speed was about, at most, was 200 by the most skilled person. So you see those massive efficiencies. So it helped change norms about women and changed our commercial practices. So what are some of the lessons that we can learn from this interesting historical story? At least I think it's interesting, and I hope that you found this somewhat interesting as well. Well, the first thing to learn from is that patent thickets or patent wars are not a modern phenomenon. They've been happening almost from the get-go with the American patent system. They happened with the sewing machine, as I just described to you. They happened again with the telephone, the automobile, the airplane, radio. They even happened in the 1980s with diapers. Disposable diapers. If you talk to patent litigators who were working in the 1980s, they can regale you with stories of the diaper wars. And that's what they were called, the diaper wars. They're not a modern phenomenon. This is not new. Moreover, it's not necessarily a property problem. There's a lot of heterogeneous factors that go into what might make a patent thicket a patent thicket. So it's not simply just a factor that there are too strong property rights. For instance, a lot of people have said in response to me when I presented this research, they said, well, yeah, four people. Three firms in Elias Howe, that's not a patent thicket. Four people, that's easy. Four people can get together and negotiate a deal like that. And I say, well, yeah, of course, in a day when we have email and telephones and FedEx and the internet and all sorts of amazing technologies that make communication really easy. But in the 1850s, four people was a huge deal. And today, you know, in 100 years from now, you know, we talk about how there's thousands of patents that cover a phone. You know, 100 years from now, they may say 1,000 patents? That's nothing. You have to have at least 1,000,000 patents before you start talking about a patent war, because who knows the type of technology that might make that not an important issue at that time. Moreover, people who license patents, who don't manufacture a license, this is also not a new phenomenon in the patent system. Charles Goodyear, the inventor of vulcanized rubber, I mentioned him earlier, he never manufactured rubber. A lot of people don't know this. Goodyear, the Goodyear Tire Company, has nothing to do with Charles Goodyear. It was just named after him about 50 years after he died because his name was associated with rubber. He never manufactured a single piece of rubber for sale in commercial product. He just wanted to invent rubber, and so he licensed his patent to manufacturers to make rubber. And he was doing this in the 1830s. But also Thomas Edison. A lot of people don't realize that, you know, yeah, Edison put his name on a lot of companies, but he wasn't running those companies. He was running his laboratories at Menlo Park. Edison invented the invention factory. That was what Menlo Park was. And so he was licensing his technology to these companies to make money from it to run Menlo Park. But he was an inventor running an invention company and licensing those inventions to other companies, like similar to what 3M does now and Intellectual Ventures and other companies. So this just goes to show you that, you know, you hear a lot of complaints today, a lot of complaints that one of the big problems with the smartphone wars, all of these so-called patent trolls, these non-practicing entities, well, they're no. I mean, these people are doing what the patent system always intended people to do. If you provide property rights to people, you can do two things with those property rights. You can actually use them and manufacture a product, or you can license it. Like for instance, a commercial landlord licenses the use of his or her land to people to rent from it. Well, that's what some people choose to do with the property rights and the inventions that they come up with. So what's the ultimate lesson of this? Well, I can say this because I'm in a room full of fellow tech geeks and maybe some of you are sci-fi geeks like me. So I'll just say, as the Cylons constantly reminded us in Battlestar Galactica, all of this has happened before and all of it will happen again. You know for certain. So. Thank you very much.
Well, that's all for this podcast. But if you have any thoughts or comments, you can get in touch with us by email at LEMCEN@si.edu. On Facebook at facebook.com/Lemelson Center. And on Twitter at twitter.com/SI_invention. Please join us for our next podcast. And in the meantime, keep up with us on our website, where you'll find blogs, video podcasts, and more. Thanks for listening.